Hey, Talkhouse listeners, it's Josh Modell. Instead of encouraging you to listen to podcasts today, I'm here to encourage you to read something great. The particular something I have in mind is the second issue of the Talkhouse Reader, the print zine spearheaded by our fantastic music editor, Annie Fell. This issue is focused on the intersection of food and music, and it features contributions from Maddie Matheson, Coleman Domingo, Squirrelflower, Sam Evian, The Blessed Madonna, and more. There are pieces about eating while on tour, the gentrification of food, cooking as a creative catalyst, and much, much more. You can order a copy today, along with the first issue, at store.talkhouse.com. Please do check it out.
Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here.
Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Fritz Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Chaim. And you're listening to the Talkhouse Podcast. Ow!
Hello, and welcome to the Talkhouse Podcast. I'm Executive Editor Josh Modell. This week, we've got a great conversation between two singer-songwriter-guitarist band leaders known for blurring similar genre lines from punk to country to pop to Americana, and who've been doing it a long time. Mike Ness is the frontman of legendary band Social Distortion, which started out in the LA punk margins way back in 1978 and went on to sell millions of records over a lengthy career. And though they haven't released an album in quite a while, Ness is working on new Social Distortion material, a lot of it, as you'll hear in this talk. Ness met Ben Nichols of Lucero back in 2010 when Lucero opened for Social Distortion, and the two got along great. In a small world twist, Ness's son Julian recently opened for Lucero as part of Jade Jackson's band. They get into that world a little bit here as well. Lucero recorded their 10th album during COVID lockdown, and When You Found Me was released in early 2021. It's a slightly mellower Lucero on display here with some 80s-styled synthesizer, think Tom Petty synthesizer, not Human League, in the mix. Check out a little bit of the song Back in Ohio. Like every other band at the moment, Lucero is off the road, though they do have a gig coming up in March at what looks like a really cool, socially distanced outdoor venue called the Caverns Above Ground Amphitheater in their home state of Tennessee. Nichols and Ness have a great discussion here about songwriting, production, and their family lives. Both have creative kids, which brings a whole new dimension to their lives and careers. Enjoy.
How are you, Ben?
Man, I'm doing great, Mike. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Sorry about the delay.
No, it was the holidays. Stuff was nuts for me here at the house. Even with the lockdown and the COVID and everything, I'm still crazy busy.
It's good to be occupied during this time, I think.
For sure. We've done a good job of keeping busy. We got that new record. It just got released on Friday. I'm real happy with it.
Good.
It's a little bit different than some of the stuff we've done in the past.
In what way?
We use synthesizers on it.
Okay.
I kind of wanted to go for a little bit of that 80s radio kind of vibe. So that's throwing some of the Lucero fans for a loop. But at its core, it still sounds like a Lucero record. Yeah. It's just got a few new
sounds
on it.
They'll
come around. It's been fairly positive response so far. Mm-hmm. Now, personally, I'm real happy with it. I'm glad it's finally out.
Good.
What have you been up to lately?
I'm also writing. I'm getting ready to do a record, but I've been for 20 years paying rent for a shop to keep my cars in.
Right.
Is a subject of contention with the wife because it's just money throwing away for rent. And I finally bought something, but I've been making that move and it's been brutal. If the whole thing would have burnt down, I probably wouldn't have even noticed it missing out of my life, some of the stuff.
Right.
Then here I am schlepping it again from one house to another. And
You're a pretty big collector, right?
Some people call it collecting. Some people call it hoarding.
Right, you know? Right.
And you don't really realize it till it's time to move it.
Yeah, I hate moving. I haven't done a whole lot of it, at least in the recent years. I got lucky because I got married about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And my wife's from Ohio. She's from the Akron area. Mm-hmm. And so when we got married, I bought a house up here. My daughter was born up here in Ohio. Okay. But I've still got the Memphis place. I've still got the house there. So that's where I can keep anything I want in Memphis. Yeah. And all the nice stuff is in the Ohio house with the family and the wife. I'm talking to you from my basement here in Ohio. What I like about Ohio is you don't have basements down in Tennessee or Arkansas. You got not fancy ones like they have up north.
Well, not definitely. I could see you got it all finished out too.
Yeah, we bought it from an old couple. He was an engineer for NASA or something, and he decked this bar out.
Naughty pine.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a
wrong with naughty pine.
Lockdown's it's cozy. Easier.
It's naughty
if you
pine,
got a cozy bar.
What anyone says about it, it's always cozy.
I've been doing a bunch of interviews from down here recently, just for this.
It's fun interviewing people, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know.
I really like it.
I have a tendency to just kind of say the same stuff over and over, and I'm like, who's going to listen to this stuff over and over again?
But I mean, do you like interviewing people, doing interviews?
I don't know if I've ever interviewed anybody, to tell you the truth. Am I interviewing you now?
First one?
Am I interviewing you, or are you interviewing me?
Doesn't matter.
I don't think it matters. We're just having a phone call, which I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Man, it's been a while.
I think our tour that we did, that y'all took us out in maybe 2010 or something like that. It was a long time ago.
Yeah. I've talked with John a couple times.
John C. back in Memphis.
Yeah, well, when you guys took Jay Jackson out, he would give me reports. And
that was really fun.
Thank you so much for doing that. They had the time of their lives on that.
So your son Julian's in that band with Jay Jackson.
Yes.
And they went on tour with Lucero. That actually, I think that wasn't too long before the lockdown happened. We were out with them.
Yeah.
But it was a good match for the band. We really were a big fan of their stuff. Maybe they learned a little bit from us, for better or for worse.
I know they did. When you're that young going out for your first, and you're with a seasoned band, it's just like school.
Totally.
Yeah, school.
We went through the same thing. There was a band called the North Mississippi All-Stars, another Memphis band. They were Jim Dickinson's kids. You heard the name Jim Dickinson. He's a producer. He worked with Big Star in Memphis, and he did one of the Replacements records. But he was well-known around Memphis, and his kids were in a great band called the North Mississippi All-Stars, and they were a couple years ahead of us, and they were playing to pretty big crowds, and they took us on our first tour. They're in the tour bus, and we're in the van trying to keep up, and you learn how much you have to work out there.
Yeah.
But all the Jay Jackson kids, they were great, and you produced their record, didn't you?
Yeah, both of them.
Both of them. How much production stuff have you done in the past?
Not a lot. But I really, really enjoy it because it's just like you're coming from the outside of the circle and you can just see things in that artist that they don't see in themselves. And that's the lesson I learned from the producers I've worked with. You know, I mean, at times they pissed me off and
totally
and telling me keep writing and. But that was some of the best lessons I ever learned was just like dig deeper and get to the deeper levels.
For sure.
You know, whether it's the writing, the lyrics, or the actual performance itself.
We kind of had an experience like that. We worked with a guy named Ted Hutt, kind of in the middle of our career, I guess. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, we'd just been, we didn't really have producers at first. You're just kind of doing it all on your own.
Sure.
And then we had some guys that were just pretty hands-off. You'd just go in there and you'd be like, was that good? Should I do it again? They're like, sounds fine to me. And you're like, okay. But Ted Hutt, he did the 1372 Overton Park record with us and a couple more. And working with him was like going to boot camp. Uh-huh. He like really put us through our paces, especially with the performances, just really trying to lock those in. We'd been pretty loose before. He was the first guy to ever come to rehearsal before we went into the studio. So he's like, man, try that verse. That verse is your chorus. And then write me a new verse or that bridge is your verse and you're switching stuff up. And I'm like, I've had this song for 4 months. What am I? Okay, fine.
I know.
And
that
outside perspective is tough to, you can't get there on your own sometimes. I've never done any production.
Really fun, dude. It's like you're steering this ship. Really fun, yeah. And you just get this focus too, this laser focus. And
I was like, man, I don't know how Ted Hutt is listening to our songs over and over and over again. Like once I've sung them and played them and I've heard the playback once or twice and done a little mixing. I'm like, okay, I'm finished. But the producer's job is to go in there and really fine tune it. I don't know if I have that kind of a attention span, but no, good for you, man. The Jay Jackson records sound great.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And you definitely learn from that, even though you're just producing, you're trying things. A lot of it is experimental. It's like, oh, I'm going to do that. I like that.
And that's the fun part about recording and music kind of in general, is that experimentation. When you don't know if something's going to work, and then it clicks all of a sudden, and you're like, oh, yeah, that does work.
I'm not sure. And then that one day you just go, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's what makes rock and roll so much fun. I remember way back to when I was 14 years old, and you're playing with some kids. The kid down the block has a drum set, and another kid has a guitar, and I was playing bass. But just getting together that very first time, I mean, we were absolutely horrible, but just hearing that bass guitar with the drums and the drums with the guitar, and you're like, oh my God, this is how they do it. Oh, this is amazing.
I know.
And you're hooked.
I remember just like there would be parties going on a Friday night, but if I had the choice to jam with a drummer that night, that's where I was.
That's kind of how I know. Me and Roy Barry, my drummer, Roy, like just the two of us will get together. Yeah. And I'll maybe have some guitar parts. And if we can make that work, like if he can come up with a good beat or a unique
kind
beat.
Of the same with me and Hidalgo, because it's really stripped down. When I was doing these pre-production last year, I felt bad because I was kind of excluding the bass player,
right,
and the keyboard player, and even Johnny for a little while. It was just me and Dave. A couple of weeks, but it's just because I really needed to just hear the kick, snare, and the guitar, and just see if it was grooving. But it's when I really groove when the bass,
exactly,
and the other guitar player come in,
and you can kind of adjust your guitar parts as necessary, real easily, because nobody else is trying to keep up with what notes you're playing. So you can change the parts around, rearrange them. That's exactly how I like to work too.
I've even tracked that way before.
We do too.
Tracking too, with just me and the drummer, really, because it's the foundation.
And it's real clean. And like you said, you can just kind of hear what's going on.
You can hear all the open space that needs, what needs to be filled in, what doesn't.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Getting together with your drummer is a whole lot of fun.
It is.
And then you can kind of figure out how the vocal patterns lay over everything. And that's kind of been our method. The tricky part with the new record, like I said, we use the synthesizer some. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of started with, my little brother is a movie maker. He's a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen any of his stuff, but he writes and directs movies.
I don't know.
He made Mud with Matthew McConaughey and Take Shelter. And the last one he made was Loving.
Okay.
But he's doing real well. He's real talented. And he's used a little bit of Lucero stuff in each one of his films, even if it's just like the closing credits. Uh-huh. But I love his soundtrack guy, the guy that does his soundtracks, David Wingo.
That skill set, isn't it?
It's a whole different ballgame. But I was just messing around just on GarageBand in the basement with a little keyboard and different sounds and trying to do like movie cinematic type stuff.
Right.
So I kind of had that stuff laying around for years. And then it came time to make a new Lucero record, and I tried to transform those cinematic things into Lucero songs. I guess part of it was I had so much time by myself. Like, usually we get together with the guys, and you get together with Roy and you jam. But this, we couldn't rehearse because we were in lockdown. So I took these other things and kind of started from the keyboards, which is something I'd never really done before.
Yeah.
We were coming at it from a different direction. I think they still ended up being Lucero songs. But it was a different process this time.
I found that like when you write with another instrument, it's just a different mind thing. Like I bought this old Martin tenor guitar about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I didn't tune it the way they told me to. I tuned it just how I would want it.
How are you supposed to tune it? tenor guitar? Is it not like a regular guitar?
I don't know. I just go E-A-E-A.
Oh, okay.
So I can bar it. So I can almost like a slide. But there was a whole nother way, and I just like, I couldn't wrap my mind around it. And but those songs translated to normal songs, but I never would have written those.
Right.
Had I not been messing around with this.
Yeah, I've heard other guys talk about that too, where you pick up either a brand new instrument or just something that you don't usually write on.
Yeah.
I took piano lessons when I was a kid. I know my way around a keyboard a little bit.
I started piano lessons. I love it, dude.
I need to take lessons
though,
again.
Man.
It's real hard. I forgot how.
Piano players probably say guitar is hard, but
right.
Piano for me is like, it's not coming super easy.
No, if I tried to take piano lessons, it would be a chore. I can plunk around, and if I'm recording, I'll record the right hand first and then the left hand second and do them separate. I'll cheat a little bit.
But
for just writing stuff, it's cool to, you come up with chords that you wouldn't necessarily use.
Uh-huh.
There's a little bit of that on this new Lucero record.
Mm-hmm. Proud of it. Synthesizers, I mean, I know that Petty's used them, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And if it's done like, it could be a great pad and create a great ambient sound.
That's kind of the thing. It creates a mood. Like I said, they were kind of written with movies in mind. I kind of wanted the record to maybe sound like, like it was
dramatic.
Setting up a story and dramatic. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Sure.
So that's what this one is. I've already started working on demos for the next record though. And it'll probably be kind of a straight ahead garage
kind of
guitar, rock and roll band type
sure.
record.
Uh-huh.
Just to keep it interesting.
Sure.
I hate making the same record over and over. So
well,
I
think we're going to do the same thing. I mean, in the last 15 years, I've accumulated about 80 songs.
Oh, wow.
I think we started working on 40 for this and got it narrowed down to 20 and then pick the best 15 and record them.
That's cool.
But what's cool is like the ones that aren't making it, it's not that they're not good. They just may not have the same cohesion.
Yep.
So
yep.
My plan is to put a record out, tour it for a year, and then go back in and record another record and put it out and put out two records within 2 years. We haven't done that like since the 90s. So
exactly.
People are going to lose their shit. You know?
That would be awesome. I'm looking forward to that. I'm hoping to kind of do the same thing. Because when you're in the studio and when you wrap up a record, that's when, at least me, I'm like, let's just keep going.
It's like keeping that door open.
Right.
In the past, when I finish a record, it's like, all right, well, close the creative door,
right.
Grab your suitcase, it's time to go and tour it. But if you can keep that creative door open, it doesn't have to end with that record. And then
it's much easier to get back to the following album. Because if you don't, it's like if you don't use that muscle for a little while,
it's
hard to get back into shape sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm in that writing kind of mood right now. So I'm hoping to keep it going. But we'll see what comes next. You were talking about having 40 or 80 songs. Do you have lyrics for all those?
Right now, I'm like, I don't know what it is. I'm listening to the songs over and over again. But I'm not writing any lyrics.
That's what
but
I do.
Like, I kind of got to go through that process because it's like, the song has to remind me of something. Or maybe I'll think of the premise as I'm listening to it. But I got to just listen to it. I got a list of like, provocative titles or one-liners.
Yep. I do the same thing.
The next phase is just kind of, once this move is done, I got to get into deep isolation.
Yeah.
Start the lyric. I think the trick is right now is I don't want to write a political record.
Right.
As a matter of fact, historically, I don't write politically because it's not my wheelhouse. But I do feel like there's so much going on in the world right now. And so it's like the trick is going to be is how to say it without saying it. That's my favorite writing by other people. It's just like, I know what he's saying right there.
Right, but he's not.
Or at least
not exactly
I'm interpreting it that way. And that's
exactly
all that matters. Because it should be up to every individual to interpret it how they
right
want.
Yeah, that's the beautiful stuff right there. Where and you're not getting preached to. You're not getting right. propaganda.
Right, or a grocery list of everything that's wrong in the world. Right. Right
we now. All know we all know that stuff. That's reading the news. But right. in a song, if you can make it apply to numerous situations or just that's we did that. One of the new songs is called "A City on Fire," and it was
great
written.
Title. Yeah.
Ah, thank you. Yeah. And it was written. There were wildfires in California. There was the marching in the streets. It was right in the middle of all that summer of 2020 stuff.
Sure, yeah.
And I felt like you, like, I come to music not for politics. I'm there for more of a personal, emotional right. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But we were in the studio and the world was just going crazy outside. And so it kind of seeped in to the songwriting
what
process.
It affects you.
Yeah, you can't help that.
You can write about the effects out. That's so accurate and honest, and it's not preachy, because if it's affecting you that way, it's going right. to be more than likely affecting this person that way.
I went through four or five different drafts of those lyrics. And
isn't that fun when you're writing and you got a full trash can?
Oh, 100%.
Crumbling up. I mean, I still write on paper, crumble it up, throw it in the trash. That's how I know I'm working.
Yeah, that song especially, because it did start off a little heavy-handed, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then you refine it a little bit, and and then you can find this word to replace that word, and this line, take this line out and replace it with something, and it makes it a little more subtle. I think the song kind of captures that intensity and that mood, mm-hmm. kind of being surrounded by flames and kind of not sure if you can find a way out of this circle of fire. I think I got it where I want it, but it definitely took a refining process to get there. And I don't want anything to be too preachy or heavy-handed. Right. But yeah, you're right. It affects you, and it works its way in there one way or another sometimes.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling the world's not going to get any less crazy between now and when you get in the studio again.
Well, one of my notes I wrote is the world's not getting better as time goes on.
That's hard for some people to reconcile. We started off as cavemen, and it's just been a steady progression forward ever since then.
Right.
That's not exactly necessarily how it is.
I do this. I mean, I try to stay informed, but at the same time, I feel like I'm just doom scrolling.
Right.
You know,
it's a.
This isn't uplifting me in any way, or
it's a tough balance.
You read about this stuff, and it's just hard to believe that this is just. I don't know if it's just a murder in this town or this going on here or this or
right.
guy cuts off his wife's head or something. And like, what the fuck, man? Like, what's going on?
It's an information overload. Everybody knows much more about what's going on anywhere all the time now, just because it's a 24-hour news thing. You got to kind of protect yourself from that. But yeah, you still want to know what's going on. And it's tough. The thing is, that's what music's always been for me. It's kind of like a retreat from that.
Or an escape,
An escape from that.
Right.
And I can just go into these records and songs that I love that take me someplace else.
Sucks right here. I need to go to a better place.
Since I was 4 years old, I think that's what music's kind of been for me.
Oh, me too, dude. I mean, that's exactly the age for me where I literally discovered music. And this took me, didn't matter what was going on at home.
Right.
I got this magical place I can go to.
Oh, man.
And escape it all.
I remember my dad had a bunch of 45s. And I had like a little kid record player. But I would put on something like the cheesy stuff is what got me right. Like Rockin' Robin or Rock Around the Clock.
Sure.
Like that
sure.
50s stuff.
Yeah.
And that's, I was like, I don't know what this is, but I like it. I want to do this. I was 4 or 5 years old. I was real, real young. I've always liked that era of music ever since. This sounds cheesy too, but that you remember that movie La Bamba that came out in the 80s?
Yeah, that's great.
Like I bought that soundtrack, and that introduced me to Los Lobos. Right. That introduced me to Bo Diddley. It's funny how like it's kind of a cheesy 80s movie, but it even that living in Arkansas, you're working with whatever you can get your hands on. And whatever you can find, it's funny how much something like that can affect a kid.
Yeah. Now, I remember seeing Woodstock and We had the album at the around the house, and but then so that was my mom's side, more was rock and roll. But then I watched Hee Haw with my dad on Sunday nights.
Oh man, yeah, I remember Hee Haw. Man, I was growing up in Arkansas, so that was Hee Haw might have been a little too close to home for me. At the time, I couldn't stand Hee Haw when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And then you find your own kind of musical tastes and paths.
Well, but then you go back, you realize that stuff was like, this has got something.
You're like, oh, wait, Buck Owens was on Hee Haw. Oh, all these great musicians, talented people were a part of that. And you're like, oh, man, I didn't realize that's what I was, seeing at the time. I think that kind of works the same for everybody, too. Everybody goes through their, their phases of discovering new stuff and rediscovering old stuff.
I was 17. I couldn't get through a 10-minute blues song.
Right. I don't have time for this.
I mean, I like Muddy Waters, but I don't think I can. I want to just give me some Ramones. But then you go to that for a while, and then you just like, you get back into it.
That's the good thing about music, is it's always there just kind of waiting for you to,
revisit.
Exactly. And it's there when you need it. If you don't need the fast punk rock songs right now, there's this whole other option over here.
Yeah.
And then when you need the fast punk rock stuff again, it's there for you. That's part of the beauty of it, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. And now I'm trying to, I got this little girl, my daughter Izzy, she's four now.
Four? It's your only one?
It's my only one, but I got two teenage stepdaughters as well. So
you got a lot of estrogen in our house growing up. With my wife, we had two boys and me, so she was surrounded by testosterone.
Yeah, no, it's the opposite for me. It's all women, and from the ages of four to whatever. And but I love it. I'm having more fun than I've ever had.
I have an uncle who was this, so I have this picture and vision in my mind of him having to meet the teenager's boyfriend. It's just like having that, and my uncle's crazy. So I would hate to be one of these kids having to meet him. It's kind of like a cross between Mickey Rourke and Jack Nicholson.
Oh my, that's horrifying.
Yeah, so I also imagine what it would be like if I was the dad interviewing those kids. And
I can't imagine what it would be like showing up and having to meet my girlfriend's dad, Mike Ness. That would be I'd be like, man, I love you, honey, but I gotta go. You could be an intimidating guy, I think, possibly.
If I had a girl, I would.
To a young suitor.
Yeah.
But you had boys, so it was different, I guess.
It was different, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was still very protective of them, but
of course,
didn't have to worry so much about that.
We've been lucky so far. The older girls have had pretty good taste in young men so far. And luckily, my wife is more in charge of all that. I'm just kind of, I'm hanging out with the four-year-old, keeping her out of the way while the teenagers do their stuff. And we'll plug in the microphone. The four-year-old loves the reverb on the microphone, the little PA downstairs in the practice room in the basement, or she'll bang on the drums, trying to let her know that she can play those instruments anytime she wants.
That's a great gift to pass on. And I remember when the kids were growing up, and it was like, I don't know if I want them in this business, man. It's tough on the marriage. Like, if you're being consistent out on the road, that means you're being inconsistent with everything at home.
It's true.
It takes a strong woman, and it takes a lot. And I just didn't know that I wanted my kids in this business. But when I saw Julian perform his first couple times, it was like, that I just couldn't deny. It just was like, this is what he was meant to do. Wow. I have to support this. And my other son's an artist, so same thing. You just want to support him. Julian started with the saxophone when he was about 10.
All right, yeah.
He was taking lessons from Jason Fries, who plays with Green Day.
Oh, wow. All
okay, right, cool. And learning jazz. But then I would get together with him with an acoustic guitar and just play a rock and roll thing.
Right.
And rock and roll is half the notes.
right.
jazz. But he had these licks, and it was like, I'm trying to get him to pick it up again because it's such
man, it's cool.
Such a good instrument.
We've got a little bit of sax on the new record. We had the whole horn section for a number of years. It's fun. It's rock and roll. And you don't see a whole lot of horn sections. But yeah, we had Jim Spake, the saxophone player, come in and play a big sax solo on one of the songs. But yeah, that makes sense with Julian. Like an instrument like the saxophone, once you kind of understand how licks fit into the song, you can then kind of, once you pick up the guitar, you kind of already have that instinct. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, no, I think, I don't know what kind of instrument Izzy will pick, but I want her to pick up something, and it can be anything, because then she can always change. And the skills you learn in one instrument, you can kind of apply those to anything you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of hoping she lets me, her dad, be her drummer for a little bit, because I've never played drums. I'm really not a good drummer.
Right.
But maybe with a six-year-old or a seven-year-old.
It'll be great.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. It's maybe we'll be on the same kind of level. I'm hoping she'll let me be in her band. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure she will. Yeah.
The fatherhood thing for me is, I don't know. I think you were talking about when you're doing your thing on the road, you're focused on that. And if you're doing that like you should, then yeah, you're kind of neglecting things at home.
Sure.
And if you're taking care of stuff at home, maybe you're neglecting the career.
Yeah, it's not that you're neglecting, but you can't be in two places at once.
True. Know? That's a better way of saying it.
And you know how all consuming being on the road is. It's like, I mean, if you don't spend your whole day getting ready for that show that night.
It's true. It's hard to divide your attention and time, use your time for anything else other than just getting through that performance.
Right.
I didn't get married till I was 41. Being at home was never that important to me up until recently.
Right. A tour to end when you're, but it's just you.
But it ended up not being it started getting a little, it's not the healthiest way to live sometimes too.
No, it could be empty.
And you can fill those hours with stuff that's not.
Because eventually that couple thousand people that night have to go home.
And then you're
kind of left with yourself.
Right, which can be dangerous sometimes. But since I got married and I've got Izzy back home, it's been actually easier to kind of balance everything. And I give them a lot of credit for just kind of, I don't know. I've got a reason to get back home now. I've got a reason to take care of myself a little more. I got people back home that are worried about me.
Right.
And I think that's really helped.
They depend on you and you don't want to let them down.
You don't want to let them down.
Yeah.
Man, that can be powerful stuff.
Sure.
To let somebody down.
Absolutely.
But then it's still nice to go out and you sing these songs. And now I've got a lot of songs about family. And everybody was worried when I got married. They were like, oh, what's Lucero going to write songs about if he's not chasing girls and drinking whiskey all the time?
Those are the only two things.
Those were the only things they allowed me to write about, my fans.
Right. Like,
if it's outside of that,
that's all there is to me.
And I got to,
hey,
you know,
guess what? I'm much more.
I don't blame them for thinking that I was only heartbreak and whiskey. I had a lot of nights that were, maybe that's all they saw. And that's all I was putting out there, maybe. But luckily, there is a little bit more. And I love when we are on tour, singing those songs about the folks back home, my daughter and my wife. It just feels so good.
Well, it's like a maturity and a wisdom happening at the same time.
I hope so.
Yeah.
But still, I think it sounds like Lucero. It's still a little melancholy and some yearning and some heartache. But it's the good kind of heartache. It's the missing the folks back home. So I think
our fans, they grow with us.
Yeah, you want them to. And Lucero's been real lucky there. We've got folks that they found the band when we started 20 years ago, and they're still there today, which is amazing. And like I've heard you talk about, now they bring their kids.
I've seen both. I've seen parents bringing in their kids, but I've also seen kids bringing in their parents.
Us too.
Which is great.
It's super cool. There's like an 80-year-old guy there, and he's there. Sure. His daughter or someone's like, my dad loves you.
Yeah.
It's a big compliment for sure.
Is.
And it makes you feel good about what you're doing. You're not stuck just talking to one segment of the population. You can actually reach out to more than one type of folks, which I think Social D does an excellent job of. I remember I was maybe 16 when your self-titled record came out. I just got my driver's license, and I'm driving my mom around somewhere, and I've got that tape in the cassette player. And she's not sure what she thinks about social distortion.
Right.
But and she grew up in Altimer, Arkansas. It's kind of southeast Mississippi Delta, all cotton fields and stuff. So when Ring of Fire comes on, she's like, oh, I know this song. Okay, these guys are all right. I'm like, yeah, see, no, they're not so bad.
That song, I remember getting a lot of flack for that prior to
really?
It.
From the punk rockers?
Yeah, I was like, you're going to record a Johnny Cash song? Why? Because I want to. I like it.
Because Johnny Cash is cooler than almost anybody else on the planet.
I'm not going to stay within these confines of like what's punk and what isn't punk. You're going to tell me what isn't punk? Yeah.
Yeah, for some folks, punk rock can become a little confining if you approach it from the wrong direction.
Well, it's just like anything. I mean, it could just be narrow-mindedness, that even something that's supposed to be open-minded.
I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and we had like a riverfront park. The Arkansas River runs right through downtown. Mm-hmm. And in the early 90s, it was just abandoned downtown. There was nothing down there. But there was a little gazebo, and so punk rock bands would just come, and the electricity was still on. So you just plug in a PA, plug in your amps, and put on a show. Even out-of-town bands started, like, calling local folks and setting up shows. You took up donations. And any kind of bands, you'd have a hardcore band playing with, like, kind of a pop-punk band playing with this weird art rock kind of Devo band.
Sure.
And it was all happening at the same time, and it was all punk rock.
Exactly.
Or some shows, like an old blues guy. I remember Sadell Davis played at one of these shows. And he's a guy he might have, Fat Possum might have put out a few of his records now, but he played with like a butter knife because he had, I'm not sure what happened to his hand, but you've just got all these different things that'll pop up at these shows, and it's all punk rock in its own way.
It was all just one scene.
I felt lucky growing up in a scene like that.
Yeah, me too.
Because it makes you think I can do anything I want. Lucero, not a very punk rock sounding band, but it came out of that scene.
I mean, I would go and see the Cramps and Fear the same night, or the Blasters and the Germs, and
that's so cool.
It was just like you didn't think that it was two different things. It was just like, everyone is here, we're all here, this is it,
right?
Whatever we're doing, whatever they're doing is cool,
right?
Because no one at my school even knows about this is even going on.
Yeah, that's the coolest part about it. That is something I feel thankful for as far as punk rock goes.
Yeah.
Just discovering that world. Folks are real quick to tell you what you can and can't do and what you should and shouldn't listen to. And
I think it's kind of like, too, like if you look for the similarities rather than the differences.
Right.
So especially going back into our history, if you look at the similarities of Tom Petty and the Ramones, or just even further back, Billie Holiday was writing about heroin and bad men.
Oh yeah, totally.
You know what I mean? So it's like, what's more hardcore than that? Core. It's real life. Sometimes say, oh, Bone Chains are very punk rock. Well, really? Well, it's about life.
Right.
So what do you want?
What more do you want? It's the genuineness that, and it's where it's coming from and what it's about, and more than how it sounds.
Mm-hmm. The rebelliousness has been going on for a long time. So you just need to look at those similarities. You know what I mean? It's like Williams and Sid Vicious.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe today, in like today's music world, with just, it's all right there on the internet for you. You can track down almost anything you want to track down.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's kind of opened folks up a little bit. They're like, you don't have to just like one kind of thing now. I don't know. I've always listened to stuff and then got into writing songs, just kind of like to get me through the long nights. It gave me something to do, and yeah, something kind of to feel good about myself. I was like, I wrote a whole song tonight. I don't care what was going on the street, what the cool kids were doing. I don't know, but I wrote this song. And then getting to play it, and it, I don't know. I like just being part of the, even if we're just a kind of a footnote in this whole musical history thing. I like that we played a hand.
A role in it.
Yeah. However small it might be, I got to get in there and play around.
We got to live our dream.
Man, it has been a dream. It's been great.
Yeah, it really has.
Thanks for listening to the Talkhouse Podcast, and thanks to Ben Nichols and Mike Ness for chatting. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the Talkhouse Podcast on your chosen platform and check us out on all your favorite social channels. This week's episode was produced by Kevin O'Connell, and the Talkhouse theme is composed and performed by The Range. See you next week.